The siege of Mariupol continues as people try to understand the conditions for civilians there.
My parents were during the siege for 3 weeks in Mariupol, and when they have seen the photos of Bucha, they said to me, oh no, in Mariupol it was much worse.
A Ukrainian politician tells us what his hometown is going through. Also today, Russian yachts.
These yachts are worth $600 million.
And these yachts are also stuck in European ports. We'll hear about the problems that's causing. Plus, Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen have competing visions for France's future.
What is a native true French according to Marine Le Pen? Let's be blunt about it.
And the music of djembe player Weedy Brema. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler, in for Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us today. We start in Mariupol, the southern Ukrainian port city on the Sea of Azov. Before Russia's invasion of Ukraine, nearly 500,000 people lived there. Now, only 100,000 people remain. The besieged city has become a symbol of Ukrainian resistance during the war, as Ukrainian troops continue to push back against Russia's assault on the city. Dmytro Gurin is a Ukrainian member of parliament who grew up in Mariupol. He represents Kyiv. Dmytro, thank you so much for joining us. What is the latest you've heard from people who are currently stranded in Mariupol?
Well, our troops, Ukrainian army, is under siege on the Azovstal territories. Today, from the Mariupol city port, troops from our border and border defense and police, like more than 500 men, they joined our forces on Azovstal territory. And also there are a lot of civilians. Mostly these are families and children and wives of our defenders. Russians are just trying to destroy the Azovstal territory totally. It's around 10 square kilometers. They're just trying to destroy all this territory with people inside.
The last time we spoke to you about a month ago, you described conditions in Mariupol as medieval. You said people were drinking water from radiator systems. Are there civilians left outside of the steel plant that you've been talking about? And if so, what are the conditions there or outside of the steel plant?
The same. Just the same. 100,000 people are still in the city. Almost no supply of food, of water. But it became warmer, not winter anymore. There is no so big need of gas and of electricity, so people, it's easier to survive. But they almost don't have supply of food and, of course, of medicine. No any hospitals. Last doctors left Mariupol like more than a week ago, and like 95% of buildings are destroyed. So it's still medieval.
As you mentioned, the last Ukrainian troops defending Mariupol are stranded in that steel plant, the Azovstal steel plant. I understand living in tunnels underneath the plant for safety. There are some civilians there, too. Why is this plant so significant?
From the military point of view, we tied up some Russian troops on that territory, and they cannot move them to the Donbas. There is a much more important point of view that people, civilians that are on Mariupol, they are families of these soldiers. And Russian propaganda, they brainwashed their people and they brainwashed also their army during 8 years that the main Nazis in Ukraine, they are in Mariupol and that's Azovis. And they understand that Nazis for Russian soldiers, what their government says are Nazis, it's not people. So after seeing what has happened in Bucha, our soldiers and their families understand that all of them will be killed and before this raped. And all of them, I mean, with children. So they don't have any choice. The last 8 days, Russia blocked all the entrance and exit from the city because they are cleaning their mess. They are cleaning the evidences of their war crimes. My parents were during the siege for 3 weeks in Mariupol. And when they have seen the photos of Bucha, they said to me, oh no, in Mariupol, it was much worse. Much more bodies on the streets. So now the Mariupol is totally blocked and these bodies on the street, they disappear. So they're collected and even they dig graves that are now in the courtyards of buildings.
This really seems like a last stand and that the fighters in Mariupol are all alone. Is Ukraine's military not able to reinforce them at this point?
We need more offensive weapon to make this military operation towards Mariupol. That's what we're asking all our international partners. We need more offensive weapons right now. Because now we have a choice to finish this war on the Ukrainian territory with the defeat of Russian Federation, or we have a choice to spread this war to the territory of NATO. And that means that you will not only give your weapons, but also lives of your soldiers, lives of your people. So I think it's very clear that for everybody that we need now as much offensive weapon as it possible.
I want to go back to before the shelling started. Dmytro, as we've said, you're from Mariupol originally. What was the city like before the war? What was it known for?
It was a manufacturing city, like steel producing, and also port and beaches. It's on the seashore. The last 8 years, it was pretty vibrant. The cultural life grew significantly. As of steel manufacturing plant, we started planning of building the university, new university in the city. So it was a city in development, developing city. Now we don't have the city at all. Of course, we will rebuild Mariupol. It's not possible to just restore it, you know, to reconstruct it. We need to build new city from scratch, and we will do it.
Dmytro, as we've said, you're from Mariupol originally. Do you know if the house where you grew up is still standing?
No, it's totally destroyed. It's black. It's a 9-story building, like 200 apartments, and it was hit by a tank 5 times, and it burned totally. So, no, I don't have the house to grow up anymore.
How is the fight for the city being seen now by Ukrainians? Has it become something bigger than itself, kind of a symbol of this war?
Yes, the symbol of our resistance, because they're Iron Man, and we all see that what they're doing, it's far beyond heroic. And it's really hard to think that your best man and you would give anything to save them, and you would do anything to save them, but you can't. And it's really hard for the whole country, for the whole nation.
Dmytro, I wanted to ask you a forward-looking question. Last month, you posted a poll on Twitter about what Ukrainians wanted to do after the war ends, travel or start a business. And you responded that you wanted to have a baby, and half of your friends do too. Can you tell me why?
Ukraine is a country of life. We are very vital. We are a southern nation. We love peaceful, and we really love life. And I think that we have to celebrate it. We need more Ukrainians.
Dmytro Gurin is a Ukrainian member of parliament. He grew up in Mariupol, and he's been talking with us about conditions there as Russia continues its assault on the city. There are few more ostentatious examples of Russian oligarchs' wealth than their superyachts docked in ports across Europe. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, many of those vessels have been on the move, trying to evade European authorities who've sanctioned the boat's owners over their close ties with Vladimir Putin. But as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports, seizing these superyachts might be just the start of the problem.
Solaris is just one of the superyachts linked to Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich. It's worth about $600 million. The yacht comes with a helipad, a swimming pool, a beauty salon, and an outdoor beach club. Abramovich, who used to own Chelsea Football Club, has been sanctioned by both Britain and the European Union. So last month, the Solaris tried to dock at Bodrum in Turkey, a port outside of the EU. But a group of Ukrainian sailors who were in the area got wind of the plan. On a small motorboat, the Ukrainians sailed close to the Solaris and shouted anti-war slogans. Today, the Solaris is still parked at a port nearby. Owning a mega yacht isn't just a status symbol for many of these Russian billionaires.
It's a place to park money and probably to launder money.
Alex Finley is a former CIA officer, now living in Barcelona. She's been monitoring oligarchs' yachts and their movements around Europe for some time. And she says seizing these yachts is complicated.
Most of these yachts are owned by offshore companies, which are paid by other offshore companies, which are paid by other offshore companies. So it's very difficult to sort of peel all of those layers back and figure out exactly who is the final beneficial owner.
And detaining these super yachts isn't like you see in the movies. Spanish police seized a yacht linked to Sergei Chemezov, a Russian arms tycoon, in Barcelona last month.
There isn't dramatic footage of officials going on board with arms or having to force an oligarch off at gunpoint or anything like this. And the yacht itself right now is just down in the port. It's not held by chains. It just simply doesn't get permission to leave.
It's not just European authorities that are taking control of these vessels either.
We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for you, ill-begotten gain.
President Biden announced the formation of a new U.S. task force last month, dubbed KleptoCapture, that would seize oligarchs' assets in Europe. 2 weeks ago, U.S. federal agents and Spanish police seized Tango, a superyacht belonging to a Russian billionaire off the island of Mallorca. Sometimes it's not the authorities that the Russian yacht owners have to worry about, but their own crew. For 10 years, Ukrainian engineer Taras Ostapchuk worked in a yacht linked to Alexander Mikheyev, a Russian weapons dealer. Then in February, when Ostapchuk saw footage of a Russian military strike on an apartment block in his hometown of Kyiv, he said he felt he had to take action. He spoke to CNN through an interpreter.
Water began to fill up the engine room and the crew space. After that, there were three crew members left on board. I announced that the boat was sinking and that they should leave the ship. I did this on my own.
Ostapchuk said most of the other crew members were Ukrainian, but he says they didn't help him because they were afraid they'd lose their jobs. Margarita Amam used to work on luxury yachts. She now runs Yachties United, a group that supports workers in the industry, and she tells me she's not surprised crews are staying silent.
I know of a yacht that was sanctioned. That crew was told if they speak about it, they will definitely not hire them back.
Amam also owns a company that provides services and interiors to luxury yacht owners. She says even for her, speaking up comes with a price.
Everybody knows if you talk, you're going to be ousted. So me having this interview is just another nail in my coffin. But that doesn't take away from the fact that this is the right thing to do.
Sometimes crew members have just abandoned the boats altogether after they've been detained. And former CIA officer Alex Finley says this leaves the authorities with a dilemma. The yachts need to be managed or they quickly lose their value. And if they sink, the tons of fuel on board could pollute the surrounding water. Finley says there's another danger too.
So when all of this is over and the sanctions are lifted, it's possible that these assets go back to those sanctioned individuals. And if they're not returned to those individuals in good condition, then those individuals may launch sort of a countersuit against the government authorities to say, well, you took my assets and then they lost all of their value.
Seizing Russian oligarchs' luxury yachts might be a good look for Western governments, but the cost of doing so might be more than anyone bargained for. For the world, I'm Orla Barry.
Now, we'd like to note a mistake in a story that aired yesterday about rising fuel prices in Africa. We incorrectly reported that Ghana's total exports of crude oil last year was $4 billion U.S. dollars. The correct amount was $783 million U.S. dollars. We apologize for the error. Just ahead, we head to Japan to understand what it takes to send toddlers out to run errands on their own. You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler, filling in for Marco Werman. This is The World. President Nayib Bukele of El Salvador is responding swiftly to a record number of homicides in his country. More than 60 people were killed in a single day last month, allegedly at the hands of gang members. Now, the country's police and military are raiding working-class communities and arresting thousands of young and poor Salvadorians. As The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia reports, people in El Salvador are debating whether the president's actions make him a hero or a villain.
About a week after an innocent farm worker, a construction worker, even a child was killed, President Bukele spoke to the newest class of graduating military cadets.
Buenas tardes.
Bukele bragged that the country's armed forces had arrested almost 1,000 gang members every day since the murder spree.
Lo que hemos hecho en poco más de una semana, nos dice que podemos.
And what we've accomplished in less than a week, Bukele said, tells us we can end this cancer known as gangs. He stood in front of a row of generals in fatigues. We will hunt them down, he said, and sooner or later, they'll run out of places to hide.
Solo tiene la cárcel o la muerte.
They could choose jail or death, Bukele said. And as he's made clear, jail is not a great option. Prisoners have been under lockdown since the end of March, and they're being fed only twice a day, beans with either a piece of bread or a tortilla. Many in El Salvador support this response, explains Ruth López. She's a lawyer with the San Salvador-based human rights NGO Cristo Sal. Organized criminal groups, most notoriously the Mara Salvatrucha and Calle 18 gangs, have terrorized entire sections of the country since the 1990s. But López argues President Bukele's police and military strategy is damaging to the whole country.
Esto es muy grave.
This is very serious, she says. El Salvador's Congress, under the leadership of Bukele's party, approved a one-month state of exemption that has allowed authorities to spy on private conversations, break up public gatherings, and arrest people without probable cause. In fact, López says NGOs have recorded dozens of reports of innocent people getting picked up by military patrols.
Well, unfortunately, this is just going to continue.
Steven Osuna is a sociologist at Cal State Long Beach who studies crime in El Salvador. He says this heavy hand or mano dura approach has been tried before. He calls it punitive populism. And it's something that a succession of El Salvadorian presidents have tried since gang violence became a problem. Osuna says police and military are primarily patrolling the country's poorest communities, and that stigmatizes everyone who lives there.
These gangs are part of these communities. We have to understand that, right? They've become a fabric of these communities. Unfortunately, they exist through criminal activity that oftentimes harms these communities, but they're also part of it. Their moms live there, their dads live there, their brothers and siblings. They're part of these communities.
Osuna says Bukele's approach only deals with gang violence in the short term. He says it doesn't address the extreme poverty that leads young El Salvadorians to either join a gang or attempt to migrate north.
It's not solving providing jobs. It's not solving providing health care or providing education, which people really need. These are the things that people really need, but it's providing an immediate response, like almost like a band-aid solution that's not really dealing with the underlying problems.
President Bukele, meanwhile, says he has found the cure to the cancer of gangs. Yesterday, he announced authorities had so far arrested more than 13,000 people. He claimed they're all gang members and said the arrests would continue. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
You might have heard about this next story, that Japanese reality TV show that tests whether toddlers can run errands by themselves. It's called Old Enough, and it's been on the air in Japan for 30 years, but just hit Netflix in the U.S. Toddlers crossing the road to go to the supermarket unsupervised has raised eyebrows. But there's a lot going on behind the scenes in Japan to help children get around safely and independently. Tisanka Shripalu reports from Tokyo.
In this neighborhood in Tokyo, second graders make their way to school between 8:15 and 8:25 in the morning. Vice Principal Hiroyuki Hata says in Japan it's very rare for children to come to school with their parents. In Japan, traditionally, parents don't come to pick up or drop off their kids, he says. It's always been this way, even when I was a young boy at school. He shows me a color-coded map. There are four routes students take to walk to school, which are carefully planned and monitored by parents and volunteers. This red-colored course is our main route, Hata says. Each student has a designated route, which makes it easy to look out for them if something were to happen. Second grade teacher Naoko Tanaka says the children are never really walking alone. The children walk to school in coordinated groups. She says it's safety in numbers. To make sure students are safe from cars, normally we hold special classes, and sixth grade students are also expected to take care of the younger students, she says. We also rely on the community to look out for the kids. Local police officers also visit the school to teach students how to cross the road. They practice at mock crosswalks. The children study a variety of situations, including how to cross the street in the rain, how to get home when an earthquake hits, what to do if you encounter someone suspicious on the way home, and how to ride an elevator safely. For instance, on rainy days, we tell kids about dangers of trucks and how umbrellas make it hard for them to be seen, Tanaka says. So we tell them not to bring the umbrellas with them. Oh, At morning homeroom, second-year students tell me about road safety rules.
Nakata Juno.
I'm Juno Nakata. I'm 7 years old. We always look left and right and cross at the white crossing. Amber Campion tells me she's always prepared in the case she encounters someone suspicious. On my backpack, I have an alarm that goes beep, beep, beep. I always have it, and if I see a scary person, I'll use it, she says. When I need help, it will go beep, 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 and I will run to a house nearby and ask them to call the police. Kazuya Takahashi is a Tokyo-based educator who won the annual Global Teacher Prize in 2016. He says in Japan, where earthquakes are common, self-reliance is a survival skill that can be learned from a young age.
If earthquake hits and the public transportation all disrupted, they have to go back home by themselves, right, on foot. So they just kind of have to memorize how to go home from school on foot.
At 5 p.m. sharp every day, a chime rings in my neighborhood, a reminder that children are making their way home from school. Second grade teacher Tanaka explains. The mornings in this neighborhood are safe as there's never been any incident at that time, but the evenings are more risky, she says. The 5 p.m. chime that's broadcast in this area lets everyone know and basically says, please look after the children as they go home from school. At the heart of Japanese parenting is a proverb that famously states, if you love your child, send them on a journey. Tanaka believes that the sense of safety and community in Japan is what makes the country special. For The World, I'm Tasanka Sirapala in Tokyo.
You're listening to The World. A Ukrainian scholar spent decades documenting Soviet oppression in Ukraine.
I remember vividly my parents saying, just don't speak Ukrainian on the streets. So there was an active repression for expressing oneself as having Ukrainian identity.
His daughter is now fighting to keep his archives safe. That's still ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler, in for Marco Werman. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. A debate is raging in the European Union over Russian oil. Despite the long list of sanctions that Western countries have put on Russia, Russian oil and gas continue to flow to Europe, heating homes and running factories. Some EU leaders warn the economic fallout in Europe would be severe if Europe stops importing Russian oil and gas. But those sales, critics say, are helping Putin pay for the war in Ukraine. That's the camp that Rasmus Andresen falls into. He's a member of European Parliament from Germany and joins us from Brussels. What's your opposition to importing Russian oil and gas into Europe? Explain your position.
We can see that in Ukraine, the citizens are fighting a fight for also European democracy, worldwide democracy, against Russian oppression. And this is really where I think that Europe needs to act in solidarity with Ukraine, and we need to do much more. And of course, the question of energy imports are quite important, because we know that Putin is earning a lot of money, and we are even giving Putin the possibility to still be part of the world economy by dealing with Russian oil and Russian gas imports. So this is the reason for why we're going to see European state leaders acting much more than they did in the past.
You've called for a ban on Russian oil and tariffs on Russian gas. Why is that the best approach, do you think?
Well, first of all, we want to see a phase out of Russian fossil fuels. I mean, also fossil fuels in general, but especially Russian fossil fuels, so that Europe will become independent of Russian energy. And then the question is how to deal with this on a concrete level. And there, I think, first of all, we should ensure that we are going for an immediate ban on oil and coal, which basically is being organized already by the European Union, and where we maybe need some more weeks for the transition period. But still there, I think we will see some action much faster. And then on gas, the situation is much more complicated also because of the economic, but especially social consequences in many countries in Europe with high energy bills and a very delicate social situation for a lot of European citizens. And one way to address this is to put tariffs or custom duties on Russian gas. Putin should pay much higher tariffs so that he's actually not earning a lot of money by selling Russian gas to the European Union.
Your home country, Germany, gets over a third of its oil from Russia. You know, if that oil were suddenly banned, what are you proposing to make up for that immediate loss of energy sources? What's going to fill the gap?
Well, I mean, on oil, we have more possibilities. First of all, we can try to get oil from other parts of the world. This is what the German government doesn't like, but still has to work on, because if you're dependent from Russia and you want to change this, then on a short-term level, you need to get oil from other parts of the world. And on the other side, you can also address this by reducing the oil consumption and take some policy measures into account, which actually is addressing the consumption. And then on the long-term perspective, we need to come out of fossil fuels. We need to phase out fossil fuels, and we need to do that much earlier than we actually already planned to do so. And I think that this is the most important point. We need to combine this with a long-term perspective, which means that we need to come out of fossil fuels and we need to invest heavily in renewable energy.
How has this debate over Russian oil and gas and this desire to move away from it changed the work that's being done toward Europe's climate goals?
My feeling is that this is not decided yet. There is one camp, and I'm part of it, saying we need to speed up. We have a problem by being too dependent on fossil fuels in general. We need to have a closer look on the European Green Deal, on the climate law, on the energy goals we have set, and we need to speed the transition up.
Rasmus Andresen is a member of the European Parliament and speaker for the Group of the Greens, European Free Alliance, in the Parliament. He joined us from Brussels. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Tourists at a Bavarian animal preserve got a treat yesterday, or rather watched as some of the animals there did. That's staff at the park giving its boars a cake made of marzipan and biscuit. Who knew they liked marzipan? To celebrate the renaming of one particular boar. He's a 440-pound Russian purebred boar who had been known as Putin. Now he's got a German name. One tourist told Reuters that he approves.
I think it's a good thing, because when it's feeding time and they call this name, then it isn't good to hear them call Putin and see him come. Everyone will probably get scared.
His new name, Eberhofer, was chosen by the public. It's the name of a police detective on Bavarian TV known for his rough-and-tumble approach to solving crime. The boar, Eberhofer, was imported from Russia and named after its president 3 years ago. But the park's manager said calling out the name Putin had become uncomfortable since war broke out in Ukraine. Now he's training the boar to recognize its new moniker. And he added, Ukrainian refugees are invited to come to the park for free. Things are getting tense in France heading into this weekend's presidential election. Tonight, incumbent President Emmanuel Macron is up against far-right candidate Marine Le Pen in a televised debate. Macron is just starting to pull ahead of Le Pen in the polls, and this debate could be a critical test. The campaign has been marked by accusations of Islamophobia and nationalism and very different visions of France's future from Macron and Le Pen. To talk about some of these themes, I'm joined by Rim Sarah Alwan. She's a researcher at the Toulouse Capital University and commenter on French culture, politics, and society. Rim Sarah, what is the mood ahead of tonight's debate?
Very tense and very dark. I think that France is so divided that you can't even feel it. And I'm speaking for myself, but I think it's the first time since I have the legal age to vote that I actually am extremely terrified about the outcome of this election. And I literally feel sick in my stomach because contrary to, you know, the past elections, I truly believe Marine Le Pen, the far right, has a chance to win. And even if she does not, for me, the far right has already won. And that's terrifying.
Le Pen bombed the debate when she was running for president back in 2017, and that ended up being a deciding factor in the election. Does that make the stakes tonight even higher than usual?
Absolutely. The thing with this campaign is, A, I didn't feel it was a campaign at all. You had a bunch of politicians yelling at each other, no real substance. Emmanuel Macron was almost absent from the debate. It is very recently that he's even taking part to the debate. He refused to do that before. To the point that Le Pen, she became, and I think according to a lot of people, that the only candidate that actually, quote-unquote, cares. And that's why I think we have a different angle compared to the last election. And especially like the political scene is so balkanized that you do have some in the mainstream siding with her. So the margin, like the reserve of votes for Macron, is way lower than 2017, even though polls are saying that he might win on Sunday. But it just shows how now normal this party is and fully part of the political landscape, even though it should not be.
Le Pen has moderated her far-right platform a bit for this election, but her campaign has still been marked by accusations of Islamophobia and far-right nationalism. Can you talk about how some of this has played out so far?
You have to read, really, the manifesto, and the devil is in the legal details. You have proposals such as preventing foreigners to come to France because they are a threat, and I quote, to France's identity. She's planning as well to get rid of the right for someone born on French territory and whose parents, you know, are not French to have automatically the French citizenship after going through some red tape. Because according to her, you need to deserve the citizenship. You know, she wants to implement what we call national preference designation to allow native-born French to access in priority to housing or social welfare. But again, what is a native true French according to Marine Le Pen? Let's be blunt about it. White Christian person. So if you are a dual citizen, if you have the wrong skin color, the wrong religion, the wrong ethnicity, you're out.
Le Pen says that she'll ban the hijab in public places if she wins. Women who wear the hijab confronted her in public over this. How was that moment seen by voters? What was the reaction?
You have various reactions, but, you know, women's bodies and especially visible Muslim women is the perfect tool to use, you know, to achieve certain political agendas from the right to the left. What she's planning on doing is completely illegal, discriminatory, and goes against the principle of equality and prohibition of religious and discriminations. But she knows very well that it is a good tool to use. You know, she is a demagogue, and trust me, she will manage to find a way to push for such, you know, an agenda. And by the way, the same encounter occurred last week with Emmanuel Macron. Again, Muslim women are marginalized all year, and yet we are asking them, and Muslims in general, and vulnerable communities in general, now they have to get their votes to vote to save the Republic. French when it's convenient to be French.
You wrote recently that Le Pen may pretend to be a regular politician, but she remains as dangerous as ever. What did you mean by that?
You need to understand the roots of the far right. This is the party that used to have Nazi collaborators within it. This is a party whose founder, Jean-Marie Le Pen, so Marine Le Pen's father, who was condemned multiple times for incitement to racial hatred by diminishing, you know, the Holocaust. This is a party that is dangerous for democracy and for the rule of law. But unfortunately, mainstream parties have been pandering to the far right for years.
Rim Sarah Alouane is a researcher at the Toulouse Capital University and commenter on French culture, politics, and society. She joins us from Toulouse in the south of France. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The musician Weedy Brema plays the djembe, a West African drum that's become something of a global symbol for African music. And he's trying to change the way it's seen and expand where it's heard, blending his family's West African roots with his experience in the United States. Brema's recent album, The Hands of Time, is his debut recording as a band leader, and he puts the djembe at the center of the music. Ufi Scruggs reported this story for The World last fall about Brema's drum, his music, and his life.
Ask Weedy Brema what he plays, and he won't say drums or percussion.
I'm a djembe fuller, and I am one that's trying to make this instrument, the djembe, a respected and sophisticated instrument, no different than your cello, your classical piano, your trumpet, your saxophone.
His instrument, the djembe, is a goblet-shaped hand drum that originated in present-day Mali more than four centuries ago. As a djembe fola, one who speaks through the drum, Brahma works to expand the boundaries of his instrument without sacrificing its identity and heritage. On the Hands of Time, Brahma and his band fuse hip-hop, folkloric music, and jazz with the help of artists like rapper Maimouna Youssef, a.k.a. Mumu Fresh, and jazz trumpeter and composer Christian Scott Atunde Ajua. But the djembe commands attention. That's not just because Brahma loves it. He wants to bridge the divide he sees between percussionists and drummers, which in many bands are seen as different roles, the drummer playing a drum kit.
Now, that's a Western trait because of the miscommunication and misunderstanding of what it is. The more you start going east, you start realizing that these quote-unquote percussion instruments is actually the melody of the music.
The album tells two stories, that of the djembe and Brahma's journey to it. His musical roots run deep. His father, Oscar Sully Brahma, was a drummer from Ghana. That's where Weedy was born, and that's where he learned to play the drum. When he was about four, the family moved to the United States and settled in Illinois.
My father started this band in Champaign, Urbana, called Bantuku. And in Champaign, there was a club they used to play at called Nature's Table. That was the first band I ever played with. At that time, I was three-four. And it was my mother playing drums, my father on playing flutes, writing the music, and also playing folkloric drums.
Brahma did more than play with his father's band. As a child, he memorized every part.
To hear that type of music as a four-year-old and to be able to mimic and say everybody's parts is what used to freak my father and my mama out.
Brahma brings those horns and energy into his new album. And he brings something else.
That was a melody that we used to play in the band. The song says, dee doo dee ba doo doo ba ba doo dee. This song is called Back to Forth. That song is an ode to my father about Bantuku.
Just as Back to Forward is for his late father, When the Clouds Kissed, 2515 is for his late mother, drummer Ann Morris.
She was the only one out of her siblings that pursued music. And she pursued music from looking up to her father, which was Nathaniel Weedy Morris. Now, he played with everybody.
The Morris family has deep roots in New Orleans, where Brahma lives now. But his grandfather left the city and eventually ended up in East St. Louis, which had a thriving music scene. Brahma's parents broke up because his mother felt her son wasn't comfortable around African Americans. But she didn't want to neglect his African heritage. So when she returned to East St. Louis, she enrolled him in a program teaching African music and dance. Her little boy was used to Ghanaian drums. The drums in East St. Louis were different.
Wow, and I'm looking out saying, excuse me, sir, what's the name of these drums? Oh, these drums are called djembe.
Brahma still plays for the community events and classes that got him started. But his djembe shows up in New Orleans' funky dumpster funk band, at jazz clubs like the Blue Note in New York, and on a 2019 Grammy-nominated album. Then he was a featured musician. Now, with his band and debut album, it's his turn to speak. For the world, I'm Afi Scruggs.
Ukraine's culture and language have a rich history and a parallel story of suppression. After the First World War, the newly formed Soviet Union annexed the region and tried to stamp out its identity. Under dictator Joseph Stalin, the Ukrainian language itself was banned. But works by Ukrainian dissidents still made their way across borders and to the United States. Many of those books and writings were collected by a Ukrainian immigrant to the U.S., Volodymyr Pilyshenko. His family fled Ukraine during World War II and eventually settled in Rochester, New York. But years later, because Pilyshenko was a university professor, he was allowed to visit Ukraine. His first trip back was in 1972. Here's his daughter, Katya Kolcha, speaking about her father.
He would be given handwritten work, notes scribbled on whatever was available by poets, dissidents, writers, and thinkers in Ukraine. I traveled with him as well. I was still young, but at that time, I remember vividly my parents saying, just don't speak Ukrainian on the streets. Make sure nobody hears you speaking Ukrainian. So there was an active repression and punishment for expressing oneself as having Ukrainian identity.
Pilyshenko kept everything from his trips. He also saved writings and books that people sent to him. Over the years, he amassed an unrivaled collection of Ukrainian writing. Kolcha says her father had more than 15,000 books.
Not only that he brought out of the Soviet Union, but that were published outside the Soviet Union. And he started his search for the materials that would be written, that would be documenting Ukrainian history and experiences and cultural identity that would have been burned or censored or banned in the territory of the Soviet Union.
He saved them from that fate. But in a cruel twist, this collection is now in danger, not due to neglect or from age, but because of the war. This is the story of what happened to Volodymyr Pilyshenko's collection, as told by his daughter. Today, Katya Kolcha is a professor at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. She was interviewed by Gemma Ware at our partners, The Conversation.
So he'd spent the 70s, 80s collecting this material. Was he keeping it in your house? What was he doing with it?
Yeah, he was keeping all of it in our house. And he was building this collection of books slowly. And it wasn't just his own work. The Ukrainian diaspora community in the United States and around the world was very self-consciously preserving books and opening schools, teaching a history that they knew wasn't being maintained in Ukraine in the hope that someday it would be. So in the Ukrainian Credit Union of Rochester, in the basement was a library, a community library where many of these books were housed. And when somebody would die, an elder in a family, the family would know to bring whatever books they have to my father. And it became part of this archive that he hoped someday would return to Ukraine. And of course, this was before Ukrainian independence, and nobody knew whether that would ever come.
And then it did come in 1991. So what happened then to this material?
We didn't quite exactly know what would happen with my father's archive until 2017. The mayor of the city of Dnipro is a city on the eastern side of Ukraine, fairly close to the Donbas zone of conflict. The mayor, Boris Albertovich Filatov, made it his mission to revive a sense of what had been forgotten about Ukraine. And he was in Rochester. They snuck off and visited my father's house. And that's when the mayor saw the collection, stacks and stacks of books, it turns out numbering over 15,000. And the mayor at that moment said, we will build you a library. And sure enough, in 2018, Mayor Filatov invited my father. I accompanied him with my son to Dnipro to find a location. And the location that was chosen is right in the city center, in the central library. And they built a wing to house these materials specifically.
And so when did the last package of books get sent?
What happened in 2021, at the beginning of the year in February, is my father contracted COVID and he died. The library hadn't been completed, so I went to work. I went to Rochester and resumed the work, and we made a plan for the group of scholars from Dnipro to come and help catalog the remaining books. September of 2021, and the books went into a container ship and sat on a ship for months. And we waited and we waited. And February 8th of 2022, I got a note in my Facebook with photographs announcing that the books had finally arrived. The container had finally made it to Dnipro, and they showed pictures of all those hundreds of books, which included my father's handwritten diaries from over 50 years.
So I guess at this point, February the 8th, the world has changed so much since then. You had no idea what would happen. Do you know what the situation is right now?
So the timing is just so extraordinary. We had no idea that Russia would launch this full-scale invasion. I know that the books are still in boxes and they're currently in a basement in the central city library, as far as I'm aware. I know that's in the central part of the city of Dnipro. Dnipro is not far from Zaporizhia. You might have heard in the news, Russia took control of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, and Dnipro is not far away. So we're extremely concerned. And of course, we worry more than anything about the people of Dnipro. They've been heroes throughout this 8-year war. They've really been on the front line of defending Ukraine as a whole. And we can only hope for the best.
And this idea of language and the Ukrainian language, is there a real fear that because they're written in Ukrainian and they tell that history, that they might be kind of a particular target to anyone who finds them?
That's absolutely for certain. In the essay that Putin published over the summer, in the speech he gave just a couple of weeks ago, Putin has made it clear that he thinks Ukrainians don't exist, that they're really Russians, that they're a subset of Russians, that there is no independent or unique Ukrainian identity. Putin is afraid of the expression of the civic vitality that is embodied in the Ukrainian people and that is embodied in this archive. Should they find it, it would be the first thing that they would destroy. And despite attempting to do exactly that over hundreds of years, they've not succeeded. So there's that glimmer of optimism that I have. But in the short term, that's what we're facing.
That was Katya Kolcha speaking about the archive of Ukrainian dissident writings that her father curated over many decades. She told her story to Gemma Ware of the podcast The Conversation. The latest update from Kolcha is that the library is still intact, but the city of Dnipro remains in danger. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The World will be right back here tomorrow.